Well, hello, everybody. My name is David Leese. I'm your proud host of Leaders on the Frontier, and a warm welcome to everybody joining us on X as well as on YouTube. We're delighted that you could join us for this live discussion, and we certainly welcome your questions and your comments on this very important topic. Did you know it's April the 1st, just around the corner, as we talk to you on March the 28th? It's hard to believe. So, are you looking forward to April Fool's Day? Well, I don't know about you, but I think you and a lot of Canadians are probably not looking forward to April Fool's Day, because on April the 1st, we've got a big increase in carbon taxes our way from courtesy of the federal government. So we want to talk about that today, about carbon taxes, and that's really part of a larger puzzle, a larger picture about this incredible effort to change your way of life. And this is going to have a big impact. And so I am delighted to welcome our special guest today, the Honorable Dan Mateague. And Dan is a great friend. He's the president of Canadians for Affordable Energy. He's also got quite a background as a minister within previous liberal governments, both in terms of domestic responsibilities as also the foreign affairs portfolio. So a warm welcome to you, my friend Dan.
David, it's always a pleasure and good to be here just before the Easter long weekend and the mayhem that we're going to see come Monday.
Yeah, who'd ever believe it that on this Monday, Thursday, just around the corner, we're going to look to a major increase in carbon taxes. And I want to break this down because I think that you bring an awful lot of knowledge and insight around the incredible long and twisting journey in terms of how we've gotten to the point where we are today. So, Dan, gosh, what are you hearing from coast to coast across this country? You're the president of Canadians for Affordable Energy. You're an advocate for Canadians. Why is affordable energy so important?
Because for the longest time, David, it's been ignored. It's been trivialized. It's been minimized. It hasn't been part of the public discourse. And it's likely that people didn't feel the real pain, the sting, or the threat to their collective livelihoods that carbon taxes and other green initiatives are inflicting on average Canadians. Now, dealing not with just energy inflation, but of course, its consequential impact on food. On the cost of living, on housing, on rent, everywhere you turn, that they're not necessarily connected, but there's an awful lot of interconnectedness. When you start messing with energy prices, it has that compounding effect throughout the economy. And David, this morning I took some time on X, on Twitter, to look at some of the stuff I'd written back in 2019, and there it was in black and white. I warned that this was going to happen, and I also warned my erstwhile liberal colleagues, don't play with this. This is, you're playing with fire. And I knew that going back a decade earlier, 2 decades earlier. It's the reason I got into going after competition issues on gasoline to groceries and saying, the consequential impact of all these things would be to lessen the ability for people to make ends meet. And I think, unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot of attention paid to bread and butter issues. And unfortunately for my colleagues, under the name Liberal, and I would say to a lesser extent NDP, it's going to likely lead to their eradicature, if you will, their doom in the next 20 months, whenever an election is called, because they do continue to want to proceed with this very, very bad public policy.
Well, this is big public policy that's going to hit Canadians square between the eyes in terms of, I think, what you've been saying for years. So bravo on you, Dan, for talking about how these policies affect the affordability of living life as ca in Canada. I mean, it's just incredible. We live in what's called the northern part of North America. Much of it is pretty darn cold, and I would say largely uninhabitable unless we had the technology to live here comfortably, like beautiful homes and all the rest. But affordable energy, right, Dan? So this is just foundational to our way of life, and they're just going right at it, aren't they?
They are, and it's not just government. It's the science community, it's media. It is people who ought to know better who've completely bought into the idea that because there is a climate crisis, I happen to believe there isn't, But now that we have unusual weather, we're alerted to this idea that somehow we've done something bad and we have to do something, you know, along the lines of tithing or perhaps looking after, you know, paying more because we feel guilty. It's really some very, very bad policy mixed in with a sort of a psychological behavior that I've never seen in Canadians before. They've been very resilient, very willing to push ahead with better ideas. But you're quite right. You've laid it out very well. We are among the most prohibitive countries in which to live, and yet we've done so much good with our resources. So much good. We have countries coming to us saying, please share some of those resources with us. But we say, there's no business case. It's wokistry, so, and it's damaging.
I think that's fascinating timing, isn't it, Dan? That I think it was this last week that the president of Greece, no less, again made another overture to our prime minister saying, gosh, that energy, whether it's liquefied natural gas or oil and gas in whatever form, Greece would welcome the opportunity to trade with us. Just, and this reminds me of the trips this, I think it was this past year that we had representatives from both Germany as well as Japan. And of course, others. I know that a few summers ago, I was in the UK and talking with an international trade representative, and we said, "Look, we could be supplying all the UK's energy needs. In fact, we could do it for all of Europe, and that would be just such a huge, I would say, impact in a positive way when it comes to the environment, and in terms of energy security with Russia, impacting." The supply of energy to Europe, Canada could be that solution, couldn't we, Dan?
Well, why not? Our coast stretches from Pacific to Atlantic. We have coasts on the Atlantic and on the Pacific. We have a nation that can deliver to both Asia and Europe and Africa at the same time. Mm-hmm. We have the third largest provable reserves of oil in the world. We're the fifth largest exporter, all of it, of course, the United States, on natural gas. And we have anywhere from between the fourth and the sixth largest natural gas reserves. Look, there's no secret, and the world knows, when it comes to resources, a stable country that knows how to get its act together and does things in a reasonable and using the highest standards available, whether that be labor or environment, is Canada. And so, we have this sort of idea that we should shame ourselves into believing that we've done something bad, when in fact what we've done is denied not just them, but ourselves the opportunity to provide energy for a much cleaner world.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Dan. So I did want to pause for a moment and ask our audience for our questions. I'm talking with the Honorable Dan Mateague, President of Canadians for Affordable Energy, as well as former Cabinet Minister in Liberal governments. And Dan brings a wealth of experience and insight on energy matters. And so when it comes to April the 1st, can you help us, Dan, understand what will be really the impacts at the consumer level when it comes to, say, filling up your tank? How is this going to impact your budget as a Canadian? Is there a short answer to that?
Probably going to wind up costing average people an extra $2 to $3 a week just for fuel, and that's for gasoline. Mm-hmm. It goes up because it goes up 3.3 cents a liter plus GST or HST or HST at 13% or 15%, depending if you're in Ontario or in the Maritimes. The reality is that that is on top of an existing. So it goes from, if you will, 14.61 cents a liter, which it currently is, plus HST, GST, to 17.61 cents a liter. All in all, we're paying about 20 cents a liter. It represents about 10 to 14% of the entire total cost of gasoline, and even higher for diesel, because it goes across the board up 4.01 cents a liter. And I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but that takes us up to about 21.4 cents a liter plus HST and GST. A pretty big impact. And that's the stuff that winds up driving costs of farming to costs of transportation, whether that be train, whether that be jet, or whether that be transport truck.
Mm-hmm. So I think your point is so important not to miss, and that is that this has a cascade effect, a domino effect, if you will. It's not just hitting people at the pump. This cascades all through the economy, because historically Canada, one of our ace cards in our economy, our levels of productivity, has been reliable, affordable energy. So they're really undermining that. So this is going to go and hit manufacturers, when it's going to hit people in forestry, mining, agriculture, everywhere you turn. Is that your point that you're trying to make here, Dan?
Yeah, it makes us generally uncompetitive, and it makes us uncompetitive not only within the Federation, within the country, but also with respects to other nations. And so manufacturers, and I speak to many of them through my colleagues, Catherine Swift at the Coalition Concerned Business Manufacturers, keeps telling me, look, we're losing ground here, and we're losing it because other countries may get around this by, you know, saying, well, we can meet our climate objectives because we weren't as trendy as Canada. We decided to shut down coal plants after we signed the deal, unlike Canada cut shut down coal plants before the deal and transitioned to natural gas. There is a significant correlation between what the government has been doing and the very alarming commentary made by the Bank of Canada, which supports the view that our GDP to capital per capita is falling, and it will fall to the lowest level among OECD members by 2060. That means our children are going to wind up being laggards in a nation in which we're always in the top 10. We're going to be now dead last, bottom of number 60 in OECD nations.
So that's a very scary point. Can you repeat that? Because I'm not sure if people would have necessarily caught that. You're referring to a recent, I think as of yesterday, report by the deputy governor of the Bank of Canada saying that there's a productivity emergency in Canada. Is that it? Is that what you're referring
to? That's exactly what it is. We per capita are not producing in quite the way we did before. Not just because of an aging population, not just because of a new population, but because what we are producing and the means by which we can make the transitions with technologies and provide the world that which it needs, we're falling behind. We are not backing our winners. Our winners are the resource sector, our agriculture sector, our manufacturing sector. Yes, our tech sector. But all those seem to be pivoting on only one thing and one thing only. Government grift, government money to go buy things that the world already knows it can make. You don't have to worry about hydrogen. The rest of the world knows how to make it in the process of making cement and all sorts of other products. The world knows how to make electric vehicles. The world knows how to make windmills and turbines. The world knows how to make solar panels. That we're saying that Canada should be able to do these things and throwing a lot of federal money and taxpayer borrowed money really suggests that we're losing the game here. And the game is really to ensure that we have something that is attractive and for which our labor market can be resilient and responsive. We're not.
No, I think you make a very good point. And thank you for referencing the significant challenges that Canada has in terms of our productivity, and it's declining, and really is a kind of an ominous foreshadow of a really what will be a declining standard of living for Canadians. Is that a fair comment, Dan?
Well, it's a proxy for a standard of living, and if your per GDP capita is in productivity is declining, it means your standard of living is in freefall. And, can't blame international factors. If that were the case, other nations would be going the same direction. After COVID, we've gone in a very different direction. We're down. The United States is up. Europeans are up. Asian nations are up. We have a serious problem, and it has a lot to do with a government that doesn't know how to govern, but at the same time doesn't know how to back its winners. And the winners that it has is keeping it in the game are being constantly assaulted. Look, I take no pleasure in saying the fact that if we were to get rid of the oil and gas sector overnight, which is what this government wants to do, we would leave ourselves in an awful situation and be very, very quickly put out in the direction of the International Monetary Fund. We would be a basket case because we would lose 10 to 12% of our GDP, and that would make a bad situation already worse. And by the way, interest rates go through the roof.
Yeah, wow. No, that is a hard-hitting analysis. I think a lot of Canadians would be very shocked to know that this federal government is on a mission to shut down Canadian oil and gas, period. That's not in doubt in your mind.
Not at all. And it's tragic because it's the 20 to 30 billion bucks every year in revenues net. And a lot of these disingenuous types keep saying if they're subsidized. If you're talking about business write-offs as being subsidies, then you might as well have that hang on every business. The fact that you would have methane regulations, oil and gas caps, that you would only block pipelines, prevent ships from getting into to supply and to take away our product. All of these obstructions have been placed under the mantra of net zero. And we have done more damage to the very golden goose that keeps this economy going. Anybody who thinks that they can run an economy less 30 billion bucks, or in this case, you know, lose about 7 or 8% of GDP or of your annual revenues, good luck with that. Because not only are we going to be seeing a decline in productivity and labor, we're also seeing, of course, a massive increase in the amount of debt this government is taking. It scares me. I served for a government that tried to get rid of it, and it was very painful. We're heading towards there very quickly with a generation that seems to have forgot the sacrifices that were made by Canadians 20 and 30 years ago.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, this country was built through the incredible hard work of many generations, and it was saved up and built up over time. It wasn't easy, but it's almost like we're just running our country down. And it's crazy. And then it's fascinating, because when you reference productivity or standard of living, I know that, and this is in all deference to South Korea, but now Canada is at the same standard of living as South Korea. And I know that South Korea is an incredible country, but we're on the way down as they're on the way up. And this is just a really bad news story for Canadians. And I know that's not an easy thing to hear, but that's really what's going on. Is it not, Dan?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to paraphrase the words of that great Korean singer, Open Gangnam Style. But, you know, we're looking at, you know, a reduction in possibilities. That song very much about some people living in a beautiful vicinity, the rest living in relative dire straits and difficulty. Mm-hmm. Look, it doesn't have to be this way. And we don't have to say that we're not going to do what we have to do when it comes to the climate. But my goodness, we are obsession with this thing to the exclusion of everything else that we have taken as a consequence of the reality about us is going to lead to our national ruin. And my appeal is to people in Toronto and in Montreal who keep voting for this and don't recognize that the calamity that they're voting for is only going to be inflicted more arduously on them than any other constituency. So if you think you can live without farming, and you can live without energy, and you can live without manufacturing, and you can live without a government that keeps its financial commitments steady, good luck with that. Because sooner or later, the wolves will be at our doors, not someone else's.
Well, let's channel our fellow Canadians right across the country, including in Montreal and Toronto. And you can help us do that, Dan. But no, that's a challenge then to our fellow Canadians to pay attention and open our eyes in terms of what's going on. So let's peel that perennial onion and let's get at this. And I want to understand what's really going on here, because you hear a lot of rhetoric or a lot of messaging saying, well, the carbon tax is a price on pollution, and this is the way to, you know, safeguard our country from the impending doom of climate crisis. I can hear or see and see Greta Thunberg's the young woman, in all deference to her as a Swede, wagging her finger at us saying, how dare we? So when we look at this, is this not the policy response to impending doom of climate change, Dan? So, man, don't you care about the environment? What shouldn't we be all in favor of the carbon tax?
Well, I think we need a great reset, but it's a great reset back to reality. And if people believe that hysteria is a good way in which to conduct public policy, then I would suggest that they want to look at the history of those who've been purveyors of this hysteria, of this panic approach to public policy making, because they've failed. In my time, I can go back to, you know, the days of the population bomb, concerns about there would be no more ice caps by 2010, the Al Gores of this world. There have been many who have come before, these false prophets who've basically said the world as we know it will end, and it's because of us that it must end, and you must do less within what you have. Look, the hypocrisy of those folks aside, and I take I have nothing personal to say about people and their private habits.
Sure.
But they want to impose on us a regime, a control, a command structure that somehow legitimizes the role of government. And if you want governments to run your life, that may work for some people, but for a lot of other people, there's a cost. And it's not just a physical, financial cost. It's one that restricts our liberties. It's one that brings into question our democracy. And our liberties that we take for granted, the freedoms that we have all fought for and enjoyed. There's a modicum of responsibility. Yes, we have that. but not at the expense of taking everything away, including our ability to make make a decent standard of living. And I, you know, I know that a lot of this is couched in, and not coincidentally, to anti-capitalism. So the propaganda machine by the left and by the Greens is eerily familiar to the stuff that we saw under, you know, regimes that followed Karl Marx. And, you know, for many of us, we're not putting up with it. If, of course, we believe there's a climate emergency, fine, then say so. But I don't believe there is. And I think the idea that we can rile people up by saying there is one and get municipalities to write all sorts of nonsense to provincial governments to shut down natural gas plants, or you have people demonstrating in the streets, give your heads a shake. You know, do not use weather as a symptom or as an example of a climate going wrong. Frankly, if you look at the longer term weather patterns, it hasn't changed. We'd like to think we have. And climate's done in periods of 100, 300, 500, 5 million years, not 5 minutes or 5 days. By the way, my good friends at the weather station, I often say, I have many of them working there over the years. You can't get the weather right in 5 hours. How are you planning to get the weather right for the next 6 or 7 years? So look, I know what people are looking for. But if you think that one gas, an inert gas like CO2, is going to cause the end of the world, you got nothing coming in terms of a day of awakening.
Yeah. So you're really giving us a lot of reality therapy today, Dan. So you're kind of making a point here that we care about the environment, but this is not a crisis. Even if you use the parties like out of the UN panel, they're modeling on climate change and temperature change. We're talking basically a degree over 80 years. Well, don't tell me that that's an imminent existential threat. And thousands of scientists agree with this point. There's no consensus on this. There's a raging debate. So, but for whatever reason, you're saying that parties, including this federal government, have taken up the cause of climate alarmism as a kind of a pretext to make a lot of big changes in people's lives in terms of the form of a bigger state. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, I'm going to put words in your mouth here.
Justin Trudeau brought in an activist, a well-known activist who 20 years ago had been considered loopy and was jailed twice, arrested twice for his stuff. That's Stephen Guibeau. Read very carefully where this guy comes from. I mean, this guy is not your average, garden variety activist. This guy is pretty serious about what he wants. And he does want us to have 15-minute cities. He does not want us to have cars. He doesn't want us to own our home. He doesn't like the fact that, we've seen examples of where, what happened in where was that place many years ago? Walkerton, where we had the crisis there, where he made Mockton and said, this is nature's revenge. Where he said, this is what happens with fossil fuels and Lac Mégantic sick. Look, if you carefully study where these people are coming from, they are on the fringe of society and their ideas are not mainstream in much the same way that you can't make an argument for a climate crisis. They have to continue to convince, to connive and to con you into believing that the world is coming to an end. And if they can do that, then of course you're going to have everyone's attention. They're scared at the idea that their climate crisis narrative is falling to pieces globally. And as a result of that, they're losing control of what they want to put in place. It's happened very quickly, by the way.
Okay, so that's fascinating because I think I'm on your page, Dan, in the sense that it seems like that whole narrative of an imminent climate crisis is falling apart. I mean, you see scientific report after scientific report weighing in saying this is not accurate. Is your sense that the government itself is actually waking up to that reality? Because I get the impression that some of these people, and I don't mean to be unfair to them personally at all, but it's almost like a religion to them. It's like a kind of a faith where they say, yes, the meaning of life is to fight, quote, climate change, but we don't want to talk about the facts and evidence. We don't want to talk about this, and certainly in the form of a healthy debate with the other side. It's very hard to get them in a room to have a debate. It's almost like our highway or, we're going to try to cancel you. So you've got to go along with this. And as a proof of your virtue, you will adopt this carbon tax and you will like it. Am I being too simplistic, Dan?
No, because I think it's pretty clear. The record is very adamant about this. We tend to take the words of the Economic Forum or the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We tend to exaggerate even some of the most weirdest of models. And we tend to think of those as the need for sudden and immediate policy, when in fact, you know, what I think we're doing here is a disservice to the reality that is about us. And that is in recognizing that, you know, these are things that some believe we have to champion. I think a lot more of us are starting to say, wait a minute, it's time to hit the pause button and to take a deep breath and look before we leap. We have challenges to be sure, but if anyone out there is suggesting just for a moment that some of our policies are based on, you know, the outcome that we want, which is a better life for people, this is not what they're after. They don't care about the life of people. In fact, let's be honest, there's a hint of Malthusianism in what they're doing. They want to control population. They also want to deconstruct population to ensure that there aren't enough people out there that are going to despoil the planet. So look, I'm willing to work with them on the environmental issues, all of them. And I think we're doing a good job in that area. We have to do more. But when you tell me that CO2 is a pollutant, then I know you're dealing with what is scientifically dishonest. Yeah. And if you're going to pursue that, you better be able to tell people that you're not following the scientific method and that you have no credibility in espousing that. We know that the entire infrastructure of money going to these grifters would come and fall to pieces the very second, as I said earlier, the climate crisis is declared not to be such a thing.
Yeah, no, I excellent point, Stan. And just to be clear, carbon dioxide is foundational to life on this planet. You know, not too far from here, there are greenhouses after greenhouses where they pump CO2 into them to nurture plant life. I mean, this is just basic science. And so there's certainly been, a tale told here that suggests that CO2 is a pollutant. I mean, it's just utterly insane. So what we have here is also, I think, a very practical discussion. And I think we could use it, we could cite a couple things. One is that even if we shut down Canada tomorrow, like everything was shut down, manufacturing, services, you stop driving, like we just went back to the Stone Age, it wouldn't make a difference in terms of the climate. And everybody knows this. So why are we pursuing policies that will change the face of the middle class? It will ruin people's livelihoods and choices that really give them a future for them and their families.
Because the very, very raison d'etre of the people who are pushing this would disappear. You wouldn't need these people. You would have to hear from these people. They wouldn't be your politicians. They wouldn't be your scribes in media, and they certainly wouldn't be your scientists. Mm-hmm. You know, there has to be some understanding of the interconnectivity between the end of the Cold War and the need for governments to find something. You know, if tomorrow I were to come to everybody and say there's no climate crisis, you know, as a scientist, as an academic, as a media, as a weather station, I wouldn't be able to make any money from anyone. There has to be some crusade towards an outcome that says something bad is happening, and how do we address it? I'm simply pointing out what I think has become more and more obvious to people is that if there is in fact a change in our climate, given that much of it cannot be done by mankind, given that we're talking about 3% of 0.04%. Of which Canada is responsible for 1.5%. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no amount of analogies you can use, but are you going to rip down the CN Tower because you found a speck of salt on it that has to be destroyed? That's what they're asking for. And mathematically, it doesn't make sense because scientifically, they're on very, very thin ice and they know it. So are the politicians who are aping the positions taken by scientists who they pay to come forward with the idea that of an existential threat. It's not.
Yeah.
And, you know, my kids are going to be here. Everyone's going to be here for a long time to come. So chill, sit back, relax, and get rid of these people as quickly as possible.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And in the meantime, hey, let's work with those municipalities like in Victoria, I believe, Montreal, and treat their sewage that goes directly right into the water. How does that care about the environment? That's absurd. These guys are hypocrites, aren't they?
Big time. And they're the first ones to jump on, you know, the latest jet to get over to their climate conferences every year. They're the same people who live excessively, but then contemptuously suggest others, you know, behave better. Don't do as I do as I say. That kind of, you know, imperialism is just beyond contempt for humanity. And it demonstrates the extent to which our politicians are out of touch with people. When someone this afternoon goes to try to buy some food for the Easter long weekend and realizes that there's some items they're going to have to put back on the shelf, the short answer is blame your Liberal NDP and Green politicians for that one, because there's a connection between these unnecessary taxes based on a fraud and a hoax and a scam that somehow we're doing something very bad by the Earth's environment. Nothing could be further from the truth. To believe that is one thing. To be bamboozled by it is another. To be hammered financially by it is inexcusable. It's time for these people, literally, to go.
Wow. So there you hear it from the Honorable Dan McTeague. He's really serving it up straight to us on so many fronts. And I think I do have a question from the audience, and that is, will the carbon tax wash as we get rebates back from the government? What do you say, Dan?
Well, which carbon tax are we talking about? The one that you currently get, which the parliamentary budget officer says most people do not get back what they pay in, because the parliamentary budget officer did what Dan McTeague did 4 years ago. You're buying a liter of gasoline with a 10% hike on it won't mean that the cost of gasoline itself is all you pay. You know full well that the delivery guy or girl or whoever has to also include that in their price. Take your Uber. It's already in there. Take your food. It's already in there.
Yeah.
No, when the rebate comes out to basically a shell game, it's not a rebate. It's a bribe. It's bribing you with your own money, but giving you far less in return. And so, but don't take my word for it. Wait till the second carbon tax hits you. In the Maritimes, 6 and 8 cents a liter is now the clean fuel standard or clean fuel regulation. That adds, and there's no rebate to that. In BC, it's 17 cents. Wait till Ontario, Saskatchewan, Alberta, Manitoba, and Quebec have to pay this. And you know what? Because the fur is going to fly. It's going to be very, very damaging. It means at the end of the day, you're artificially adding to the price of the energies that we need to live and that energies we need to get by on. By the way, no EV is built without fossil fuels, and a hell of a lot of it.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I'm talking with Dan McTeague, and so I welcome your questions, and some are coming in here, including, do you think this will break up our federation as provincial premier after provincial premier opposes this carbon tax?
No, I don't. I think the pain is going to get worse. I think the Bank of Canada is now having to look at the fact that inflation may be here a lot longer, and it's going to have to make a quick decision as to whether or not it maintains these high interest rates, maintains them because the federal government is spending money hand over fist. We're going deeper and deeper into debt. Now, I think the Federation will survive, but only on condition that there is a new government that is prepared to take a completely 180-degree shift away from this. Now, I've said to people this morning, one of the best ways you do it, cut off all the funding to these charities because they don't do charitable work. Start putting the audits back on those charities. Make sure that all of the grift that we've put out there is sound. In other words, it's standing on its own. No more subsidies. We're a nation in debt. We can't afford frills like subsidies for rich people to go around virtue signal. I think the government does that. It sends a very strong signal, not just of the first carbon tax, but the second carbon tax, and now mentions the folly of pursuing net zero. If a government comes out and says nix net zero, they'll have a landslide majority for several generations.
Wow. So are you saying that this carbon tax issue, and it's kind of like an iceberg issue because it reflects so many related issues as you've outlined, is kind of like the tip of the spear when it comes to almost like a referendum on the current NDP Liberal government then? Do you think that's where we're going to be heading in the next election, that from a policy point of view, this is going to be the question?
Well, I think it's the question already. It's going to remain, but I think between now and the next election, more will be added to it. Yes, it is the low-hanging fruit. It's easy to go after it because it doesn't do what I think even its own architects. Now, economists have said, oh, this is perfect. This sends a price signal. William Nordhaus, the climate economist who came up with the idea and advocated and wrote for a carbon tax, said it works if you don't wreck it by putting in other regulations, which this federal government has done. Clean fuel standard, emissions caps, methane caps, national building code standards, electric vehicle mandates, reduction, in all these other add-ons that the trendies like Mr. Guibo and his gang from the various activist groups around the world have larded on, will destroy the impetus of the one carbon tax, which was designed to maybe change and modify behavior. However you look at it, it is very much a lightning rod issue, but it's not the only one. Get rid of the carbon tax and you still have big problems. You can't get pipelines built. You can't restore the significant importance of the Canadian dollar. Look, I'm 135 pennies to buy a U.S. dollar. Every commodity we have in this country is priced on the U.S. greenback and a relationship to it. We no longer have the petrodollar status. So it's costing us, we're losing one third of our purchase power. No wonder people feel frustrated, David.
Yeah, no, exactly. So that's another part of what a lot of people don't think about is the affordability crisis, is the decline of our dollar. And again, that's a very powerful indication of a decline of a nation.
It is, and it demonstrates the extent to which no one has confidence in our future. But that's only because we're telling people to get lost. It wasn't just the prime ministers and presidents and chancellors of some of our best friends and trading partners that we said take a hike where there's no business case. I mean, we've been saying this to large companies who wanted to build LNG. You know, it was 2017, $36 billion that was offered by the Indonesian company, whose name escapes me right now. I'll think about it in just a second. We said no. We created this environment in which we basically discourage people from making those investments on something the world desperately needs. So
I think it was called Petronas.
Petronas, that's right. So Qatar, Australia, United States, they can build it all. We can't. That says to me that this is signaling an example of a political behavior of political interference caused by the federal Trudeau Liberals that has scuppered not only our chance of getting products to the world, but also damaged everybody because we have a Canadian dollar that is no longer shielding us against the vagaries of these inflationary hits that we're taking left and right, and it's not going to end.
No, I think that's a brilliant insight, Dan. So help us understand another part of what's going on here. Like you were formerly a Liberal insider, so to speak, and the Liberal Party has a long history, obviously, of governing Canada. And more recently, you had, well, like prime ministers such as Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin undertaking really a kind of a transformative fiscal change of our country when we looked at massive deficits and debt. And they had the courage and the insight to be able to deal with that deficit. And they came out of it as a pretty popular government, so to speak. So what do we have now in terms of a leadership in that Liberal Party? I mean, is it the same party that you were familiar with? Like from a policy point of view, and I mean this not in a partisan way, I mean this in an objective policy perspective. If you look after issue, are we dealing with the same Liberal Party that you...
Well, no, not at all. Not at all. And it would be easy to point this out because the same Liberal Party of today would not forget the sacrifices of the Liberal Party of yesterday in getting the financial house of the country in order. And it did so not because Liberals thought it was cool or because Conservatives weren't doing it. It's because we got the cooperation of the provinces and people who said, yes, the situation is out of control. It is now out of control again. This is a group of individuals who took over power and took the finances of a good country and basically directed it off a cliff. And as a result, save and except for bond rating agencies who are somehow mystically still believe that we can use the CPP as some kind of leverage, as some kind of collateral against our ever-growing deficits and debt. If it were not for that miscue, which no government can use, I know they've tried. I know our government tried it in 1996, 1997. We were just that desperate. But there's signals that the government's going to try to do that as well, and it can't. It's vested where it is and kept arm's length from government for good reason. That aside, I think we're looking at a very different Liberal Party that doesn't understand how it got itself into this position, a government that spent money well before COVID, billions of dollars, put us in further hawk for no reason at all. So rather than filling up the proverbial silos, they depleted them. And then when we truly needed it, we sunk into even further debt. My concern isn't numbers. It's not about being trendy. It's that you've now compromised in the future the social programs that have come to protect Canadians, their pensions, their health care, their education. All these things are going to be compromised and are very close to being so in the months to come. One fatal move by the finance minister in her in a slip of the tongue could finally get the bond rating agencies to downgrade our credit. If that happens, then all hell will break loose. It's inevitable.
Okay. So, gosh, you're articulating something that's pretty familiar to you from years past, and that is we're kind of at the tip here where if you have a downgrade on those bond rating agencies, your interest rates go up and increased debt costs go up, and then you start cannibalizing the real program spending that people rely on in terms of healthcare and education and all the rest, then you are kissing goodbye the future of your kids' future. That's what's going on here, isn't it?
It is. And what it took us to get out of it last time wasn't just some pretty tough decisions and provinces having to see less spending and offered from the federal government. We cut back on provincial programs and some of the obligations that we had. We also had the advantage at the time of a growing U.S. economy and more need for Canadian oil and gas. If you want to know the tractor that helped pull us out of that, it's that we built four or five pipelines. The Americans loved our oil, and that put billions of dollars back into the pockets of government coffers so we could pay down that debt and get the country back where it needed to be, get the government out of borrowing. That's not something we can look at anymore. We've despoiled that. We have basically gone into our own kennel and soiled it. And as a result of this, our wokeness and our inability to understand that there is a fine balance of finances between, you know, fiscal and monetary responsibilities, we've given up the ship. And as a result, it's going to take someone else a long time to fix, if they can at all, fix the fact the Federation is so deeply in debt. And I'm not just talking the federal, the sub-sovereign debt of the province. My province here in Ontario just recorded a $10 billion deficit again. And yet it's because of green energy. A lot of it has to do with green energy and having to pay people, subsidize people so that you protect them from the full effect of the Green Energy Act that was delivered 10 years ago by the same liberals running the show in Ottawa. You have a real problem on your hands, and I'm not sure how you're going to resolve it. I'm just glad I'm not in that business anymore, David.
No, and I think, Dan, there's something that it's very interesting as I've listened to you carefully over the years. You've strategically used the word grifters when it comes to green energy. And I think this is something that is kind of confusing to people, because when they go around and they see these windmills turning around and they see these solar panels, they think, gosh, that's the future. That's the green future utopia that we're all striving for, a carbon-free, quote, future, net zero. But that's not what's going on here. Those things are all built and founded on oil and gas, ironically. But it's all subsidized by the government, by you. Is that right, Dan?
Correct. In my province, windmill operators were offered access to markets. Didn't matter. At any time, whether they were producing or not producing, they always had the ability to sell at much higher prices than the markets. Same for energy such as solar energy. What it did is it forced up the cost of hydro to average people of, 8-9 cents a kilowatt hour to a high of 33. Now, we don't pay 33. We pay 18 or 19. The reason we don't pay 33 is because the provincial government, since 2018 or 2017, has implemented something called the Ontario Electricity Support Program. That program costs taxpayers $10.3 billion a year and growing. It'll be $20 billion in the next 4 to 5 years. In other words, it is sapping monies that would otherwise go for more productive reasons, and it's being larded on to our total debt here in Ontario. That's a very scary situation, but it's what happens when you have fools messing around, playing games with green energy, when Ontario boasted among the cleanest energy menus in all of the world. You don't take my word for it. This little thing, which I always often like to keep around, what happened in 1965. A little town called Pickering brought in North America's first commercial nuclear reactors. Zero emission. long before it was cool and trendy. We threw those away in favor of pie in the sky technologies, and now we're paying a price that our grandchildren won't be able to afford.
Yeah. Well, what I like about your attitude, Dan, is you've articulated well not only the case for affordable energy, but with pride, you've said how Canada has one of the best portfolios of clean energy now between hydro, nuclear, oil and gas. Like we should be proud of the energy mix that we already have. Right, Dan?
We're the best. We're not boastful, but we are the best. And there are very few people. And where someone does better than us, we'll find out and employ that technology. Because we always want to make sure that we're number one on all scores. ESG, the famous environmental, social, and governance, we're pretty much the top producer barrel for barrel for anybody we can compare around the world. And as I mentioned, you know, we have hydroelectric in Ontario. We've had nuclear in Ontario, Quebec hydroelectric, the Maritimes. Yes, we have coal in some places, and yes, we have oil, and yes, we have natural gas. We're also one of the most energy diverse nations on the face of this planet. So we, you know, based on the circumstances, based on the geography, really based on the need, based on the climate, the weather, we have harnessed all of these things, and we are an example to the world of how to do these things. You know, it's not by accident. Nikola Tesla showed up not 50 kilometers from where I am right now here in Milton, and built the first operations of the Adam Beck back in 1910, 1915. So look, we're not big on boasting what we've done, but when we do it, we're among the best, and we've got a track record to prove it. We shouldn't allow this generation of cancel culturalists in the Liberal Party to destroy, undermine, and forget that getting here wasn't easy, and that they taught us a lot about how to stay here and get better.
Right on. Yeah, what a great history and great legacy that we should be proud of. So we need to tell that story well. And one of the things I'm also intrigued about, Dan, is this whole so-called ESG movement, the environmental social governance movement. And my interpretation on it, among so many others, is it's really a kind of an index that the wokus use to employ on all kinds of use of our money, including on our beloved Canadian pension plan, to impose all kinds of actions and biases on the use of that money. So instead of maximizing my pension return, they're undermining it for their woke causes. Is that your take on it too?
Well, I mean, if you're going to undermine a country or undermine our ability to, you know, to make ends meet, you've got to have a plan that says these things can stand on their own. These things will, you know, manage to make money, raise money, and fund themselves. Saying that you're going to depend on governments in perpetuity makes no sense. No one will buy something if it's going to always require not just command and control, but, you know, my tax money to support it. Now, Henry Ford didn't need a subsidy to build the Model T and replace, I'm using an analogy, horse and buggy. But that's exactly what we're seeing with the electric vehicle. And I love electric vehicles. They're fun to drive. It's all sorts of wonderful, you know, attributes. They're a computer on wheels, but you can't have a class of people, you know, running poor, paying their tax dollars so others can have the luxury of driving around these things. And ultimately, we know that these things can be used reversibly. There are times when they can control when you can have it, when you can't have it. Ultimately, you know, they're not free rides. And so when it comes to ESG, I guess the proof is now in the pudding. After 10 years of this stuff, we're now starting to see a lot of the big funders and hedgers move away from them because they are not sustainable without massive dollops of public money to support them. We used to call these the NDP, David Lewis's father, Stephen Lewis, or Stephen Lewis's father, David Lewis, used to call it the big corporate, what do they call them? Corporate welfare bums. Well, these are now becoming climate ESG grifting bums. And I think we have to recognize their game and the gig is known and it's up.
Well, I like the way you're calling these welfare bums out. So that, good on you. So as we look to action, Dan, what can citizens do to stop this kind of insanity? I mean, I know that, ESG begs the question, have a heart to heart with your banker your financial advisor and say, I don't want my money going into some ESG pot. I want good returns. That's certainly a logical action. What are other things that citizens can do here, Dan?
Talk to your family, talk to your friends. There's nothing more powerful than the collective desire to make change happen. I, as a politician, have run many campaigns for many liberals in the past. I've run many of my own campaigns or been involved. When the public makes up its mind, it's hard to turn that around. And I think the public is becoming more of the view that the status quo is not sustainable. We can't continue down this road of believing that we're all the bad guys and that we have to give money for green pie in the sky ideas that at the end of the day cost us more than we can possibly afford. Anybody who's out there proposing a lessening in a condition in which we live is somebody we ought not to be listening to. More importantly, we should be telling them to live according to their own rhetoric. And you'll find that they don't. They're usually the ones driving around the nice vehicles with the 15 different homes, you know, trying to scare the bejesus out of all of us in terms of telling us how bad we are and how bad we're doing. I don't fly around the world. I do my own thing. I try to do things on internet as we do, and we're all doing the best that we can. I think it's important on a weekend like this, Easter weekend, families sit down and have a pull aside with your kids. Say, listen, we can't afford to make ends meet. Here's why. And, you know, this idea that you can have, you know, universities cancel ideas and culture and have this whole idea of critical theory and all of this other stuff that we have been beset with over the past very short period of time. It's time to break the yoke of ignorance and cast aside those who do not put as a primary condition for their elected office, the willingness to help the human condition. While recognizing we have responsibility to everything, we also have responsibility to this generation and to the next. And we're not going to do it by saddling them with debt or scaring the bejesus out of them, as I've said earlier, by telling them there will be no future. And that's exactly where the climate grifters get their support. They get money and then they get the alarmism. I've had enough, and I think most Canadians have, of climate bedwetting. It's time for it to end.
I like what you're saying, Dan. Let's stop the climate bedwetting, as you say. I've never heard that before, so I'm going to quote you on that, Dan. Right. So if we look at the other side of the equation here, what are the politics of this in the sense that is a lot of this a lot of just, to use your word, grift? It's just a lot of pigs in the trough, to use that analogy. Seeking free rent, so to speak, going after the taxpayer's dime and feeding off this, because I just marvel, like you do, at the amount of money that this federal government has spent. It's spent more money than all the previous federal governments combined in our history. It's stunning. So yeah, we have this record amount of debt. If memory serves me correctly, it's hard to keep track sometimes at $1.2 trillion. It's just shocking. And this is all really, I would argue, a immoral tax on the next generation. And I'm not saying there aren't some cases where you borrow money legitimately for building, say, like a capital project, like a bridge that future generations will use. But no. This is the world where people have not only bought into this nutty world of modern monetary theory, where they think money grows on trees.
Well, doesn't it?
This is an amazing. So I know you don't believe in that, but what they're doing then is they're using your money and your next kid's generation's money to basically buy political favors with their coalition of groups across their political spectrum. Isn't that what's going on here? They're just doling out money to their friends.
Well, they're doing it under the assumption that their environmental scare story works. You know, you've got to cause panic and hysteria for people to give not only leave of their mind, but also be willing to open up and give what money they have towards the cause. And yet it's proven to be a fallacy time and time and time again. And so I think we need to look at the fact that what has been erected here is not going to be dismantled overnight. Big climate has been around for a long time, and they become more and more powerful by riling people up into the belief that somehow they're responsible for the world coming to an end. However we approach
this. It's really a huge industry. It's a
massive, massive, trillions of dollars.
People's lives.
trillions of dollars. Look at the climate summits, 70, 80,000 people showing up, flying in from all parts of the world, you know, mm-hmm. from administrators, bureaucrats, business, mm-hmm. even business has to say something. Yeah. Tell me an organization or business that doesn't talk about its sustainable side. It's hardwired into our minds. The problem with all that is sooner or later, someone is going to say the emperor has no clothes. Someone is going to call them on it. Someone is going to finally say, look, the entire thing is predicated on gas. And you're saying that this is bringing the world to an end. And if we don't do something and pay a lot of money up front, and we don't diminish our population, we don't begin this whole process of shunning other parts of the world that have never been able to enjoy what we get. You know, people in Africa who burn dung to make their meal, and it's that the emissions from that real pollution that's causing them to be very sick, and denying them the opportunity to use coal that they produce for their own needs. These are things that, these are the kind of discussions we would normally have in university among academics and students, but you're not allowed. The conformists that want to run the show, and a sidebar of a big climate, really shows the eclipse of reason among a variety of very important issues that in the past we would have tackled very easily. So it's going to take a shift back where you have to break. And I think we're starting to see that break. And if that doesn't happen, then geopolitically, let me put back the foreign affairs cap. Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and a handful of other nations are prepared to take it away from us. We want to sit back and be woke and be stupid and be ridiculous. We better watch what's happening, because as we're getting weaker, they're getting a lot stronger.
Well said. So speaking of your former foreign affairs hat, Dan, you've seen this file over the years. The influence of the Communist Party of China in the Western world, across, well, the broader world, but including in Canada. Just a few weeks ago, we've had the so-called inquiry start up into Chinese influence into the Canadian scene, including federal elections. What's your take on that? Do you have any hope of getting that we'll get to the bottom of the amount of Chinese influence in our society?
I think it frightens those who know that they benefited from it. And that may be at least two of the three political parties that we are familiar with in areas outside of Quebec. And that's probably why we're not going to get to the bottom of it under this government. We know that the NDP will block any attempt at trying to get greater scrutiny. We're seeing this with the Winnipeg Labs and, the theft of what could be material that was ultimately used in the Wuhan laboratory to create COVID, for which the world is now there. Some scary stuff. The Canada was playing no small part in indirectly or negligently allowing these things to happen. Whatever the consequence, the reality is it's going to take a whole new government to expose the extent to which our public servants and our government and our governance has been compromised. It's a very scary thought when you think that while governments are too busy pretending, CO2 is a bad thing, we have the entire country being literally taken from under us. And I worry deeply that the influence isn't just about China. It's many other nations that have an interest in Canada, may very well have people here who have an interest that is not completely Canadian. And we're starting to see that in other manifests in other areas. The kind of anti-Semitism that I'm seeing is not incongruent with what we're seeing in terms of tensions between groups. And we have a government that seems to be pandering to it. Very scary. I never thought I would see the day, but that's exactly what's happening in Canada. It's enemies from within, and it's the fact that we have been compromised that is very much part of the narrative and the discourse that we need to consider in this country as we head toward an awards election, which we have to be mindful that this is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So I would share your concerns. So what a good challenge, an articulate invitation to open our eyes to what's going on in our country in terms of many things, including foreign influence. It is interesting that Canada's national microbiology lab in Winnipeg, a level 4 lab, was it's now documented the kind of spies that were leaking information systematically to senior officials within the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army, of information regarding scientific data that was very important to the Wuhan lab and the development of COVID-19. So I am disappointed that the current federal government is not just fessing up and releasing everything around that so we can get to the bottom of this. Because this really undermines the level of trust, does it not, in our institutions and whether or not people are actually working on behalf of and serving Canadians.
You have to wonder why the government has done so much to try to suppress this. If it were not for the fact that it would be concerned like every other Canadian, true Canadian, that is concerned about the sovereignty of the nation. Attempted obfuscation, getting this RCMP to look in different directions, political interference. We need to get to the bottom of this, but it's very clear that by now it is evident to most Canadians that the country has been compromised and likely the results of the last election, which again reinforces the notion that this government is governing very much on a basis of a mandate that it really didn't have, or to the extent to which
Just
that
hold on for a
mandate.
sec, Dan. I don't want to bury that headline. So you're saying that the theory of foreign Chinese influence in the last federal election and how that may have changed the outcome of the last election, that's a legitimate theory that we can't dismiss. We've got to get to the
No.
bottom of that.
No, and if there were 10 ridings that were affected as a result of it, that would lessen the Liberal NDP coalition by 10 seats, in which case there would be no coalition. This is pretty serious. This is a government that's dangling by a thread. Like it or dislike it, it wouldn't be able to hold, the kind of sway in what is now going to be, perhaps in the parliamentary British tradition, the longest minority government that has ever served when it's done after its 4.5, 4 years. So what this really tells us is that there may be a significant amount of illegitimacy to this government as a result of what is there. Now, we won't find this out
Wow.
because the government's doing its best to muzzle, as it's done on so many fronts, from the Wii scandal to the SNC scandal to, there's so many of them. It's really hard to keep track. And I would never have thought a government able or capable of hanging on, surviving even one of those. You think of how we had to go through the Gomery issue back in 2004,
Indeed.
2005. We didn't survive that. Canadians held their governments to account. So did the media. But now you have a media that won't. These are dogs that won't hunt. And they're, in fact, trained and paid not to. And this scares me because the usual checks and balances that you need in a system to maintain its viability and its integrity have been seriously compromised under the aegis of one man, the Prime Minister, who, as I said earlier, is dangling by a thread. If there were 10 seats that
So,
were compromised, the outcome had changed. It would have changed the dynamic of of Parliament, the seating of the House of Commons today. We wouldn't have a Trudeau government today. I'm confident of that.
okay, so I encourage your audience to take note of Dan's analysis here regarding that. And I would also encourage us to remember that there's been some very significant points of legislation introduced now. Dan, we see Bill. What is it, C63, the so-called on harms safety legislation, which in my perspective is really about undermining people's freedom of speech, shutting down based
Trojan
on
horse.
some bureaucratic or czar based on what they think hate speech is. I mean, it's just a disaster when it comes to shutting down freedom of speech, which is so vital to our democracy. And then you have the whole reality that you have a government that is funding systematically over 2,000 media outlets across the country, and they've
Yes.
all got to sign on to their code of conduct and how they're going to cover certain angles to issues. They have done a masterful job governing like they've got this massive majority, when in fact they're a minority government hanging on the thread to systematically undermine all those institutions, as you say. Am I looking at it too cynically?
No, and I think it brings forth the idea that Justin Trudeau, in fact, admired China's basic dictatorship. You're seeing authoritarianism flexing its muscle in a number of areas, and they are able to control part of the narrative and the agenda by having so many people who are beholden to them, like it or not. If you have and require money from the government to continue functioning, you're in effect an appendage of that government. You are a proxy of that government. Now, it doesn't mean that you're always going to follow everything they say, hook, line, and sinker. But in the past, the traditional independence and perception of independence of the media was always something we could count upon to ensure that the public was always kept informed of what was happening by our legislators. And yeah, there were many times I got taken out and scrutinized, and I was good with that. That's what the system, that's how the system functions. It's healthy, it's dynamic, it's no longer. And that's why I think we're seeing a stasis in our electoral system, which combined with all of these other factors that we've just mentioned, foreign interference, unwillingness to scrutinize bad behavior, the ad scam. I mean, there's a myriad of these that have come out, any one of which should have taken down any legitimate government in the past and has not done so now. It suggests to me that the game is almost over and our democracy has been badly wounded here. I don't know how we're going to recover it quickly, but we need to get to another election quickly and settle the score. And if Canadians from Montreal and Toronto still want to vote for this nonsense, well, you know, I just make sure it's fair and democratic. But at the end of the day, if you still think that the way the country is going is the proper way, then maybe a trip around the world to countries where this has already happened might be in order for those who think very little of our nation and its major, noticeable, globally noticed decline.
Wow. Well, Dan, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. It's not been easy because what you've shared with us are really, in many ways, profound messages, but also prophetic ones regarding the state of our country today and what it, where its trajectory is in the future. And I want to thank you for the kind of leadership and courage that you have and as president of the Canadians for Affordable Energy and for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thanks for having me and look forward to doing this again.
Well, thank you everyone as well for joining us this live discussion. We really appreciate your questions and your comments, and we really value that. We want you to also encourage you to like the program, share it if you think it's important, get the conversation going with your family and friends, as the Honorable Dan Mateague talked about. But in the meantime, I want to wish you a blessed Monday, Thursday, and Easter, and wish you all the very best. Until next week at the same time, thank you for joining us.